Welcome, Sega fans, to the Sega Guys podcast, where we celebrate all that was great and good about Sega when they made hardware for the home. I'm Dan the Mega Driver, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, the Sega Saturn, to my Sega Mega Drive, James the Segaholic. Mate, how you doing?
I'm very good, mate. I'm very good. Just good to get a final chat in before finishing up for the paternity leave, although the topic that has brought us together at this time is quite a sad one, but always good to get behind the mic and talk Sega, and we're going to honour a legend in this episode.
Absolutely, mate. It's this one we thought we'd missed our last chance to get a recording in together, so it's great that we finally have, because yeah. The day that this goes out, we'd have recorded this the night before, which, given the news that we're going to talk about, should be fairly obvious. But it's the end of an era, because effectively, 4 days from now, or 4 or 5 days from now, you'll be a father of three rather than father of two. So, and that will be keeping you busy. So, be rest assured, our podcast fans and those of you that are watching on YouTube, you will still see James's contributions that he's been working very hard on, getting them, working every minute he can to get some content for you, to see you through while he's taking a little bit break, and it'll be like you've never left, mate.
That's well, you're watching me talking about Dreamcast and hopefully Final Fight, if I can get that one done, and Game Gear games and whatnot. Yeah, I'll be actually changing nappies. So there you go. That's the reality of the situation. But you guys, we've got all the good stuff. Got a couple of pods in there as well. Got some guests lined up for the community to come in as well. Tom Fum, Gaming for Ages guy, stuff like that, are going to kind of come in and help out here and there. So all good, mate. We've got a wee support system in place to get us through. And then I'll be back as soon as I possibly can. Looking at about 8 weeks, I'll probably be away. Yeah. And then we'll see what happens for there, but all going well, it will be like I'm not really away, even though I am, so.
Indeed, mate, indeed. But so this conversation, you know, some sad news that happened on the 13th of February. Hideki Sato, the legend behind so much Sega hardware and much of Sega's identity, as a matter of fact, sadly passed away. Age 75, and this one, mate, I think we just had to get a podcast together to share our thoughts and our memories, and just to celebrate the work of the man himself. Social media has lit up with a lot of tributes to him, which I think has been really warming from a Sega fan's perspective, because everything is usually so Sony and Nintendo focused, and it does feel like he really is getting his props, and rightly so, because the man was an absolute legend, wasn't he?
Yeah, a giant of the industry. You know, it's not kind of an exaggeration to say that he's literally shaped so much of our childhoods, teenage years. I mean, even the fact that we're sitting here doing this, you know, it's because of him. And obviously we're here to celebrate, you know, Sega, and that's what we do. And, you know, we look at all the games and all the systems and the arcade, and we touch on everything. But, you know, Hideki Sato's contribution, you know, his hardware was, for the most part, the backbone for which these games were built on. You know, they were the foundations. They were platforms in the sense of being like a hardware platform, but they were also platforms for Sega's creative teams to build on and give us those amazing experiences, you know what I mean? So it's a real loss. I mean, it's one of these things where it's the same with music and with, you know, movies as well. See the favourites that you've got, the people who shape, you know, the things that are important to you, that you enjoy when you're younger, in your mind's eye, like, they never age, you know, and they slip out of the public kind of, you know, spotlight, and you still hear about them, but you don't really see them or hear from them. And, well, you're getting old, unfortunately. Yes, so are they. And it's in your mind, as I say, you still think of them as what they were whenever you were enjoying the things whenever you were younger. But he's just an absolute giant, mate. His impact on the industry is immeasurable, you know. And I'm not on social media, so you know I've long left X, so I've not had a chance to kind of see it. I will maybe jump on with the pod account and have a wee look and see what people are saying about him and check out some kind of tributes and stuff, because it is warming to hear that he is getting these props, you know, and rightly so.
Yeah, I mean, he really, as you say, mate, he really is a giant of the industry who really did shape so many lives. And you're spot on when you talk about the fact that, you know, the game, everyone talks about the games that we love, but he created the hardware. He created the canvas, you know, the platform for these other artists to shine. And, you know, and so much of what we talk about when we're talking about things like the Sega Saturn's VDP2, the Secret Source, or when people talk about blast processing, even though it was just a buzzword, you know, there was something underlying in there in that the Mega Drive's processor was clocked relatively high compared to the competition, which allowed it to endure for so long. It's those little things. And, you know, even today, and it's just like you think about all of Falco's gains that he keeps finding on the Dreamcast is down to a hardware that he designed, or Frogball creating Minecraft on the platform, you know, on the Sega Saturn. It's all stuff that comes down to him, and it really is just underlines the genius in his designs, I think.
That's it. I mean, we laugh about Falco's gains on here, right? But, you know, those are gains that are being found because of the hardware that Sato built, and the kind of the sad thing is obviously developers during their day didn't kind of quite tap in as far as we would have liked, whether that's due to life cycle or whatever, you know, costs, development costs, whatever. But to see that the community has got so many talented people that they've taken his platforms and they've, you know, put the time into digging right into the metal and seeing exactly what's in there and bringing out that extra potential. Like, Minecraft on the Saturn, it's ridiculously good. I mean, it's no right to be on there, but, you know, it is, and it works really well, and, you know, there's a real, you know, passion out there, a real intent, I think, for the community to actually build on it and make it a proper Saturn-specific, unique version, not just a tech demo. So, I mean, this is people that are just using his hardware to build their dreams and to kind of let them show their ambitions and their talents. And the thing is, I'd love to know if he was aware that people were still so passionate about these systems, like, outside of Japan. Like, it's just why, was he ever aware of, I'm not saying he's going to be aware of us, right? I don't know, but I'm talking about in a general community level. Did he realise or did he know that there's such a massive, like, Saturn community, Dreamcast community outside of Japan that are still so passionate about these systems? Does he know that people are still playing these games on the original hardware? You know, I would have loved to have known if he was aware of that. And I hope that he did, and that he took, you know, a bit of kind of personal pride in the fact that, you know, something he built had endured for that length of time. You know, even if you go back further than the Saturn, you go to the Master System, you know what I mean? SG-1000. There's still people that are massive fans of that hardware and still use those. So, you know, I'd love to know that he knew how much his work was loved and how much it was, you know, still used to this day.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I really do hope that he was, you know, he was aware of something like Final Fight MD was doing something like that on the Mega Drive, or Grand Theft Auto Vice City on the Dreamcast. And even the SG-1000 still gets homebrew games, because in the SMS Power competition, there's still submissions that basically focus on the SG-1000 part. So, you know, there's passionate gamers in the community and passionate programmers and designers out there that are making use of this hardware, which is, you know, the Master System's 40 years old, you know, the Mark III, 40 years old, the Master System's 40 years old this year. And it's crazy that, you know, that he had such an imprint on people's lives. I mean, we probably can take it a little back. I mean, he was born November the 5th, 1950, in Hokkaido, Japan. Don't have much information on his background beyond them, but graduated from Tokyo Metropolitan Technical College, where he basically learned his trade. And basically went straight into Sega in 1971. And for those that probably don't know, back then, video games companies were very guarded of their members of staff, their programmers. You know, it's not like today where you've got your cast names, your programmer names all in the credits. That's kind of why you'd see if a game had credits, it would all just be kind of pseudonyms odd names that you'd see in there. So it's very hard to track down who actually worked on games. I imagine that was the same for Sato. Obviously, I imagine he was very closely tied to the hardware side. The first game that he was actually directly credited for that we can evidence was Monaco Grand Prix back in 1979. That was another discrete arcade board back when you'd make... back when arcade boards didn't have, they were all bespoke to the hardware, really.
Aye.
You know, you didn't have your Model 1, your System 22 or whatever. He then worked on Turbo in 81, but really his key roles came in hardware design. And I imagine he had roles in arcade games before that, but the first big one was it's really such a milestone when you think about it. It's the Sega System 1 arcade board.
Yep.
That came in 1982, because that really kind of that was the one that really drove that change for Sega, because from the Sega System series you had the super scalers all the way up to System 32. You had System 16 and System 16B that the Mega Drive was based on, and it all kind of comes back to that kind of nucleus of the Sega System 1 board. So the first game on that was Star Jacker. So I don't know if anyone's ever played that, but that's the vertical shooter where you start off with a kind of four ships all following each other. But that one is a really cool little game, and the fact that he started off with the Sega System 1, I think, mate, it shows that legacy, doesn't it? That's probably where he planted his flag, first of all, to show what he was capable of.
No, I'm just laughing here because, like, 1979 he joined Sega. Well, 71 he joined Sega, but 79, sorry, Monaco GP, the first game he worked on, was born in 79. You know what I mean? So
puts it into perspective, doesn't it?
It does, mate. He's just, as I say, the impact that he's having. But, I mean, obviously, look at the Sega System boards, look at the legacy they've got, the journey they went on. As we say here, it was like obviously Sega System 1 Arcade 1982, SC3000 in 1983. But you go between, it was kind of always moving between having impacts on software and hardware. He had his main ties, everybody knows Sato for his hardware, but it's actually interesting to see the number of games that he actually had a hand in, and not as a designer, but in an executive role, you know. Yeah. So he was. What that entails, I mean, you're talking about executive directors and, you know, obviously executive producers, executive management, you know. So he's probably got in there and imparted a fair bit of, not clout, but I think a fair bit of experience and kind of having his say on the direction that those games are going to take. So it's a lot to go over. We can't possibly cover his entire body of work.
No, you know,
it's so far reaching. We're just trying to do our best to kind of touch on the kind of high points, obviously, of this. But I'm just looking at Monaco GP. It was a discrete logic arcade board that he was designed in the hardware for that. Just crazy, mate.
It is. I mean, he obviously worked, I think it's probably fair to say that he probably worked on a number of discrete boards, but that was probably one of the ones that he first got credit for.
Yeah.
And we can trace it back. But obviously, he'd been with the company 8 years before then. And by the time he designed the System 1, he'd been with Sega for 11 years. And from there was the chief designer of both the SC3000 and the SG1000. So Sega's first assault at the home market with the computer version and with the home console version, which was ultimately ended up being the more popular one. And the SG1000, it was a shame that it launched day and date with the Famicom in Japan, because unfortunately it suffered a little by comparison, but it was still a very capable piece of hardware for its time. And the fact that Sato worked on both that and the SC3000, I know that there's hardware parity between the two, but, you know, both of them are tailored to different markets. The fact that he kind of designed both is kind of crazy. And of course, he'd be involved in the SG1000 Mark II, obviously the Mark III, which would become the Master System. Though it's hard to know how much he was involved in the redesign of the Master System. I was trying to get some clarity on this earlier, but I was thinking because the Master System did get re-released in Japan, and when you look at the Master System itself, it very much shares the same features, the same sort of visual design cues that you'd see in the Mega Drive and Sega Saturn, you know, that
sharp
black
edges
design.
And all that, yeah.
I do wonder if he had a hand in the Master System redesign when it came to America. I don't know what you think.
I mean, again, they are very similar design language, aren't they? The cases form, say the sharp edges, the kind of colours on it as well, the control panel on the front with the reset button and whatnot. You like to think that it did have. I mean, I was just looking, obviously SG-1000 was 1983,
Yeah.
and then you've got Championship Boxing in 1984, which was obviously where himself and Yu Suzuki would cross paths and their collective talents would cross, and that's another journey that, you know, goes off on another tangent. You know, you think of what, you know, Yu Suzuki did on hardware made by Sato as well. So it's just, if you look at it, like Yuji Naka, you're looking at all the kind of names of the people that made these games, the people that we always give, the people that get the credit first, you know what I mean? But he's laid those foundations. He, you know, he blazed that path. He gave him that. You used the word canvas earlier, yeah. Mate. It was a brilliant word to use. That's exactly what it is. But I'm looking at the SG-1000 games list. Jeez, oh man.
Yeah, SG-1000, SG-3000, just to catch onto a thread that you were talking about earlier, 1983 was the year I was born.
There you go, mate. There we go.
Yeah, I'm as hardware as old as I am, and it's like you were saying earlier, mate. You kind of take for granted that these people that have had such an impact on your life are, you know, that they're aging as well. And he was kind of well established in his role. He'd been with Sega 12 years, would have been in his 30s when he designed it. While I was just in nappies. Which is it's crazy, but yeah, and obviously while I was being born, he's laying the foundations for what would be, you know, our passion, you know, would form this channel. And it's, you know, there's the Master System side of things. You know, I went into detail in the video that I did just around, you know, how that was formed with the, you know, the processors and the graphics chips and everything else like that. And it was for its time the most powerful console there was. And I think pretty much everything that he did, SG-1000 aside, because the Famicom came with its whizzy new abilities on the same day, but everything else as it came in was the most powerful system of its day. You know, the Mega Drive, Saturn, the Dreamcast, they all had that same impact.
They all pushed the envelope, mate. I mean, I know there's obviously the age-old, decades-old discussion about Saturn versus PlayStation in terms of power, but, you know, the Saturn, in a sheer technical aspect, is a more powerful machine just because it was harder to program for. And you had to work a wee bit to get the results out of it. Doesn't mean that it's inferior, you know, on a technical level, it is a more powerful machine, you know, pound for pound. But aye, I say I had to bring these two, honestly. You know, I mean, they're very shiny. That's the one that get polished up for the occasion. That's my 60 hertz one. So, I mean, again, Mr. Sato designing the machine that I was lust after and ended up getting shafted out of getting. But Sato-san, I got one eventually. So there we go. You know what I mean? But you think about the impact, like the Mega Drive, you know, you think about obviously the Genesis impact in America and whatnot. But if you think about the way the Mega Drive was perceived over here, that was peak Sega for us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To see that machine bringing those kind of arcade games into the home, given Sonic the platform to become the mascot, to become the titan that he's become as well. Again, it's just another one of these branching paths of Sato's legacy. And again, as we spoke about the homebrew scene, you talk about Final Fight MD, you look at the stuff that like Pyron's doing, that Master Linkway's doing, you know, it's the Mega Drive scene, I think, is arguable. I know the Dreamcast scene, the Saturn scenes are really catching up now, but for the longest time, especially the Brazilian guys, the stuff they're doing, you know, even look at the Robo Z as well, he's doing the Mega R-Type port, you know, bringing these games over, just again, learning to push this hardware, showing that the constraints that we had back in the day were due to memory cost, wasn't due to limitations of the hardware. If you had unlimited memory, obviously we can have ROM sizes as big as we want now. We've got other drive cartridges, we can put whatever we want on an SD card. But, you know, that just goes to show that there's so much in there, which again goes back to the point you made. Whenever these systems came out, they were the most powerful of their time. And they were the most powerful of their time when they really couldn't be pushed as far, you know, due to development kind of skill sets and whatnot. You've got to remember, talk about the Saturn. Whenever it came in, we spoke at length on the channel about, you know, the 3D arms race, as we like to call it, you know, the race to 3D. 2D's old, get to 3D. And it's like looking around Sega like, hey, who can make 3D games? I'll get a shot. We'll make Virtua Cop on the fly. We'll learn on the job. You know, so these platforms that he gave, there was power in them that nobody at the time had actually even touched. And it's only now. And the thing is, there's still more to find. There's still more nips and tucks to be made. And that's the exciting thing over the years ahead, decades ahead. Who knows what they'll find, what they'll be able to do.
Yeah, it's crazy that the longevity that his hardware has because of the fan communities. And yeah, what you were saying just now about the Sega Saturn, I always consider it kind of the Super Nintendo to the PlayStation that the Mega Drive was, that the SNES was to the Mega Drive, because the SNES, in terms of raw power, it was slightly more complicated, had multiple chips that did different things, you know, had these whizzy effects. And, you know, in terms of raw CPU grunt, you know, the Saturn wasn't as powerful, didn't have as powerful a single processor as the PlayStation, but it could do all this other stuff. It's just that you'd have to get all that stuff working in tandem. But he knew what he had on his hands when he was designing it. You know, he had that background with arcade technology. He'd worked alongside Yu Suzuki and Co. for years at that point. So he knew what he had. And I think that's the thing. People talk about the Saturn's development as kind of chaotic. And maybe there was a little bit of kind of reaction to the market at the time. But overall, he didn't really stray from the vision he had. You know, there's talk about the chips that were the main processor that was in there. And obviously he was primarily, you know, he had the idea for the CPU was the CPU at the end of the day. But I think the VDPs and everything was always kind of in his plan from day one. Whereas, you know, at one point it was a Motorola 680. Other times it was an NEC chip, same as the Model 1 board. But ultimately it was the business deal with Hitachi that dictated that. But everything else was his design.
If there's one thing can people please do to honor the man, is stop saying that Sega threw a graphics processor in at the last moment. If you're going to do one thing to honor the man's work, stop saying that, because it was an extra SH2. The VDPs, and I know that CPU and GPU weren't used in the terms of the time, and I know the SH2 that was added was to help with you know, calculations and computations and whatnot, and it did help with pushing extra, you know, quads and whatnot, but both VDPs were in the design from the start. And it wasn't some chaotic last-minute panic where they seen a PlayStation and rushed into the boardroom and ripped open the motherboard and found a space for it. That's the thing that gets me, right? The last-minute stuff. Like, the motherboard was already... It's not as if they kind of opened up and went, just squeeze the other one in there. It's like, just fit it between the... Put it between the RAM chip and the sound chip there. Just wedge it in. It's like there had to be, you know, it would have been way before it went into anywhere close to manufacturing stage. I mean, prototypes of this and everything, but yet it was at the last minute. It's like people with no idea how building the hardware probably works. So, to say, I've got my lovely... Yes, it's got a bit of a yellow tint to it, but I think it gives it character. But it's still the most gorgeous video game console ever made, in my opinion. So, yes. Thank you.
Absolutely. I do wonder how much he had involved in the actual, because obviously he was involved at a technical level, and I do wonder, did he have as much influence over the exterior design as well? I do kind of think that he did, because especially the consoles of that era that he was involved in, you can see the kind of the same, as you're saying, it's got the same DNA, the same design cues, you know, the edges and how they, I mean, it's gonna be 2 secs, and I'm just gonna grab this one.
We've got props. Props, Dan's reaching for props.
Yeah,
there's a Master System
Mark One, and you know it's got the same the color scheme and
mate,
the Mark
how
One's
nice is that front panel that Top Vent put on that? That is shiny, mate.
It's beautiful.
Oh, that's real smart.
Yeah, gorgeous console, and very much of its time. It's definitely, it's obviously an 80s console, but it still kind of screams, it's still kind of, you know, people were using it in the 90s. It's kind of, it was futuristic of the time. Obviously the Mega Drive's an 80s console as well,
yes,
but they were kind of,
yeah,
so that, but it was kind of a forward-looking design that endured, and it's still, you know, and we've said it a lot of times, mate, you know, out of, you look at the consoles today and they're very kind of bland, lacking in personality. You look at the consoles that Hideki Sato was involved in, and they're all stunning. You know, even though this one is relatively straightforward looking, it's still a gorgeous little machine.
Yeah, Dreamcast. I mean, the thing about Dreamcast as well, if you think about, if you've ever worked inside a Dreamcast earlier, like change out the drive for an ODE, or they put a different power supply in, or just even service it, it's amazing how tightly compacted it is. There is no wasted space at all inside that Dreamcast. And I remember as well, there's an interview, I'm sure there's one with Sato, it's issue 67 of Edge, and it came with this amazing Dreamcast supplement, right? Big square supplement. And it was inside the Dream Machine, and it was at a teardown. It's a big interview with Sato, and then as well about, you know, the design of the Dreamcast, and you can get it on Sega Retro as a PDF. If you go on there and just type in Edge, and it'll show you all the issues. I'm sure it comes up as 67 supplement, and it's fascinating, and they break it all down, and they talk about the water cooling, the liquid cooling, and all that, which isn't quite as, the reality isn't quite as absolutely outstanding as it. I mean, I remember reading that and going, "Whoa, liquid cooling! This is how powerful is this? As he uses liquid cooling and all that kind of thing." But it's got a big heat sink on the fan and all that kind of stuff, like the metal plate on top and bottom of the motherboard and whatnot for dissipation. But aye, just the design of the consoles, mate. They're just so unique. And that, like you said about the current day consoles, that's a sad thing. It just feels like all they are, you know what consoles remind me of now? Alienware PCs.
Yeah.
Remember that? You could get the most generic motherboard, graphics card, sound card, RAM you wanted. You put it in a fancy case, and that's what made it unique. But it was an Alienware. It was no different to stuff you could buy in any other shop, but it was a case that made it different. And that's where we are now. All you've got is cases that are different.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Everyone's working from basically the same canvas.
Aye.
You know, it's not like, you know, the Sega Saturn, the Mega Drive, the Master System, the Dreamcast, they all gave different tools. You know, there's a lot of talk now at the moment around kind of games that were getting remade from the Dreamcast onto other platforms, and that no one could recreate the lighting model that the Dreamcast had. Like, everything always looked better on the Dreamcast, and nothing could really replicate it for some reason. Even the modern day, you know, you got people working on kind of the Sonic Adventure PC port on Steam. They mod the hell out of that, and they get it looking kind of quite a lot like the Dreamcast version. But it's just like, there was just something about how the Dreamcast renders things that the few seem to be able to replicate. And, you know, it's the same with Sega Saturn. The same as we said many, many times before, you know, if you were looking for a magazine and they didn't have any words on there whatsoever, and it was one title and you had three pictures, and one was N64, one was PlayStation, one was Sega Saturn, you'd know instantly which one was which. And it's just something you don't get anymore, which is kind of sad. And I know you get kind of, you get Mark Cerny, who obviously has Sega affiliation. You know, he's kind of the PlayStation kind of celebrity kind of architect. But you know, and I do like Mark Cerny, and he did some great stuff with Sega as well. But he doesn't kind of, he's not trying to shaping. What he's delivering is something very much iterative, rather than everything that Sato did had so much of its identity, personality, fueling essentially kind of a lot of people's passion for gaming and Sega in their heyday. And that's what I think his ultimate legacy is that work, is that passion ignited in, you know, his peers, his friends, and, you know, his audience, who would be us and every Sega fan around the world.
So you're talking about Mark Cerny there. It's in a way, the work he did with PS4, it's kind of similar to what Sato did with Dreamcast. He kind of corrected the the perceived problems with the previous iteration by making it much more streamlined and easier to develop for, a much neater design as well. So there's a wee bit of kind of similarity there.
Yeah, but, there is, yeah.
You know, but it's like, as we say, the reason we're sitting here doing this, you know, is because of his machines, and because of Sato's machines, you know, it's immeasurable, the impact that he's had with. I mean, sure, if he hadn't come along, I'm sure Sega would have found eventually someone else who would have designed hardware for them. But, you know, it's the soul that's in these machines. And that's the thing as well. It's like, whenever we talk about playing retro games, and we'll never sit here and tell anybody this is how you should play. I'm not going to say you must play on this, or you can't use that, or you shouldn't use this. But there is something special about playing, and especially Sega games. I think that a bit of them is lost when you're not playing them on the original hardware. It's like, it's the only games I've ever felt that with. Like, I could easily play Gears of War on a PC and not feel any kind of disassociation, but I couldn't play Sega Rally, VF2, Last Bronx, Fighting Vipers, Knights, Panzer Dragoon Saga, Zwei. I couldn't play all those games. I could play the games and I would recognize them, and I could, muscle memory would kick in, and I would enjoy them because they're amazing games. But looking down under my TV and not seeing that is, that's part of the experience for me.
Yeah.
You know, and that part of the experience comes from Sato. That's his the final bit of the jigsaw. That's his bit that's in there. So whenever you're playing a Sega game on the systems that he designed, that feeling that you're getting, it's not just if you're playing VF2 and you get that feeling, or Sega Rally and you get that feeling. Yeah, it might be coming for you, Suzuki and Tetsuya Mizuguchi, because they made the games, they designed the games. But there's a little bit of it at Sato. The soul is Sato's impact on it. And for me, that's the biggest impact, is that whenever you're playing on these machines, it's not just the games that you enjoy, it's the way it's been delivered to you via those consoles that just puts a cherry on top.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Absolutely. It's this that is that little bit of Sato magic that you put in there. And yeah, you're saying earlier that Sega would have found someone else to create the hardware for them, but they chose Sato. And you got to imagine, you know, Sato came in 71. Sega had just been acquired a couple of years earlier by Gulf and Western. And at that point, Sega already becoming kind of a heavyweight in the arcade game scene. And ultimately, you know, his time working there with other people that would have been working on discrete arcade boards or arcade games at the time, you know, they chose him to spearhead their first, the Sega System 1, and then their console movement after that. So yeah, it's that kind of magic touch that you had, I think, that's special, and that's part of that gameplay experience. And I think on top of that, mate, everything that you hear about him, you know, from his interviews, from interviews of people around him, he was just a great guy. You know, you know, and you read about his relationship with Kaz Hirai from Sony, and they go out, and obviously Kaz would tease him when Sony were in the ascendancy, and you know, he just seemed to be a very likable person. You kind of get that from a lot of people putting tributes on social media, as I've been saying. just saying that he was more than anything just a really great amical bloke. And you know, this ultimately, you know, once after you know, that Sega kind of left the console scene in 2001, you know, Okawa passed on and forgave all his debts to them, that's when he actually stepped into the chairman's seat and was basically running the company for a couple of years. And to be honest, mate, those couple of years with him in charge were great ones. You know, when Sega really were going at the kind of the PlayStation, GameCube, and Xbox with some massive titles. I mean, it's frustrating that those so many of them were exclusive, so you had to have a GameCube and an Xbox and a PlayStation to play them all. But that those first couple of years before the Sammy merger were absolutely astounding periods, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, we've said it so many times that's the kind of line in the sand moment. You know, whenever the Sega that we grew up with kind of ceased to be, and then also get the Sega Sammy on the other side of it, and we always talk about Outrun 2 being like the last hurrah of the old Sega, you know. And I, what you're saying there, mate, obviously, you know, we've seen the footage of Sato doing the press conference where he announced to the Japanese public that Dreamcast would be no more and it would be, you know, essentially become platform agnostic. But that's his leadership on a corporate level. So he's having to step away from games and hardware, obviously, because there's no hardware anymore. That must have kind of hurt him as well, I think, because
I was just thinking,
you
that.
Know, because for him to sit up there and basically say that Sega are not going to do what he did best anymore. You know, I know he's worked in arcade, but you know, boards earlier on in his career, but primarily he was home hardware. And you know, you think about all the effort that went into Dreamcast. I mean, I've just literally called up that Edge supplement, by the way, on another screen here, and it's issue 67. I'll put a link to the actual supplement in the description. Right, we'll do that because you should check it out. It's on page 13. There's a really good interview with Sato on there. Also one with Ida Majiri on the following page. It's a brilliant supplement. But you know, just again, that all that, you know, passion and effort and trying to right those perceived wrongs from Saturn that the public from certain segments kind of thrust upon it. You know, there was people, Sega themselves got great results from Saturn, but the wider gaming development community sort of obviously struggled. And again, he's took that back in and he's went to the drawing board and he's tried to come up with a system. You know, so for him to, I think if anything, the Dreamcast may have been one of the more personal design choices that he's made, and to see that killed off early must have really hurt. But to see obviously Sega then say we're not going to do what you do best, essentially, would have been a real sore one. But he's moved into management, took that on board, and he was also the man who started to broker the takeover deal, you know, and there was negotiations with both Sammy and Namco at the time as well. So you imagine that, Sega Namco. We almost had Sega Bandai.
Yeah, that was 97, 98.
I remember that in Sega Saturn magazine, like, what? Bandai? No. Oh. But, the announcement was in February 13th, 2003. Decision was made to merge with Sammy, and then in 2003, Sato and COO Tetsu Kamaya announced that they were stepping down from the roles, and Sato was replaced by Hisao Oguchi on the Sammy side. See you on the Sammy side. Does that sound right, does it? but that's not going to become a thing, so that's the last thing you'll be hearing that, by the way. See you on the Sammy side. It would have been a shame to see his reaction to Sega stepping out of hardware, but the fact that he kind of handed the reins over, helped get the deal over the line that essentially secured the future of Sega following Okawa's, you know, passing, that he took over the mantle and kind of secured the future of the company. So again, that's another part of his legacy. Yeah. That he was part, you know, again, Sega's thriving in the modern day, whether rightly or wrongly, you agree with the way they're doing it, you know, the franchises are doing it with, the hate that Yakuza gets from segments, you know, with the community as well, but you can't argue with the results. But the way Sega is just now in the hands of Sammy, he pushed forward with that deal. He said that he would select the partner that fits the business best, and it was Sammy that was chosen. So,
yeah,
you know, he's also got that, and his legacy, the modern Sega, exists because decisions that he made at a corporate level.
Yeah, and you think of the alternative, which would have been Namco. I mean, you look at what Namco had done with Taito. And then how often do you hear about Taito? Taito were a massive,
they were a giant, man.
They were titans of the industry in their heyday.
My favorite Taito game is Volfide. I loved that game. Remember
they
that?
Made so many good games. Yeah,
what a game that was.
You know. They were absolutely massive, and now they're a footnote. They wouldn't Namco occasionally try out a Taito game, the Taito license. If that was Sega's fate, it would have been extremely sad. But for whatever people think about modern Sega and modern Sammy, you know, and if so you do that, draw that line, and you do see post Sammy that there's a change in Sega. But I think it's probably better than the alternative ultimately. But yeah, you made a great point then, mate. What would he have felt? It would have been interesting to see what his reaction was to seeing, you know, withdrawing from the hardware business, because, and we've all read the interview that he gave when he's talking about the Sega Saturn. He talks about going, you know, for lunch with Kaz, and going, Hideki-chan, just come and work for us. Where'd you buy your CD-ROMs from? You buy them from us. Where'd you buy it? And he's saying, but we didn't want to leave hardware because we're proud of what we did. We'd had success, yep. And we didn't want to. And you get the feeling that he was extremely proud, and rightly so, about what it was that he'd achieved with his previous hardware, with his Master System, Mega Drive, you know, with the Saturn, you know, at that time. And it must have been really frustrating for him to say, you know, he's built all these consoles, built one that came out on the same day as the Famicom. And of course, the Famicom could scroll sprites, got scroll screens, and had more colors and sprites. People leaned to that one, so built a better one, was the Master System. But for some reason, didn't get success anywhere because everyone was too obsessed with Nintendo, apart from Europe. So he's got success in Europe, makes another one, doesn't catch fire in Japan, but it blows up in America, huge success in America, success in Europe, and then goes to Japan. Launches a console, massive success in Japan, and then disappointment everywhere else. It's just like
your Dreamcast launches to great success initially in the US and Europe, but the Japanese completely shun it because they're happy with their sounds.
At some point he's had success at some point somewhere in the world with every single one of them. And unfortunately, it needed to be total success for them to be deemed a success at all, which is crazy, really. But the lesson you take from that is it's not the hardware's fault. You know, somewhere, someone's been able to take that hardware and build games that a region has loved. Look at the Master System; it's still being built in Brazil to this day. You know, 40 years later, albeit I think the latest version is more kind of emulation on a chip sort of thing, but it's still referencing his design, even if it is just in that form. You know, it's still his legacy that people are playing there, which is insane. So. Yeah, you got to have the feeling that he was immense. You got from that interview that he was immensely proud of what they'd achieved. You kind of feel a bit bad for him that Kaz was really teasing him like that. It did make me angry a little bit reading that. I was thinking, you prick.
And they're like, you know, come on, where'd you buy your RAM chips from? Where'd you buy your CD-ROM drives from? Where'd you buy this from? And it's like, and that was the one thing Sony had going for them. They were making all these other devices. That they had the factories making this shit already, whereas Sega were having to outsource and bring stuff in the Hitachi deals and whatnot, but they were proud of their hardware, you know. And I think that's the thing we've always spoke about as well, is that when you look at each Sega system, you know what they were trying to do. I know the SG-1000 essentially did have arcade. They were more or less like for like in terms of the arcade, but the home consoles were essentially scaled down versions of the arcade boards of the time. That, I think that was the aim, was that, right, so that's that generation. We need a console that can do, you know, versions of these games at a respectable level for consumers in the home. And then obviously there, as we move through, like Saturn had STV kind of tied to it, which gave it one for one kind of parity, Dreamcast and Naomi as well. So, you know, it's, and even at that, I mean, he's not credited for designing Naomi or STV,
Yeah.
but yet people have taken his console designs and made them into arcades machines,
Yeah.
which is again
Absolutely.
taking these games and those systems into a different market. So it's just, again, branching paths. You think about all these, it's like a multiverse, mate. You know, it's like, it's,
It
there's one thing I
is.
always wondered, mate. Where do you think whenever they changed that to Genesis? You know what I mean? Well, I went, gentlemen, we did. No, it's a Mega Drive. I designed it as Mega Drive. That's its name. It's a Mega Drive.
Yeah, you got to love the, because it's in the PAL one, and it's in my Japanese one's wired in, also it'd be a bit of a pain to undo, but it's got Mega Drive on the same bit, but just on the US one it's got Genesis like stuck in the middle. And apologies to all our American viewers, but I don't like that. I don't like that look.
It's, you're used to what you're used to, you know, if that's what you grew up with and that's all you knew, then that's it. But it's called a Mega Drive, mate. He designed it and called it a Mega Drive. You can call it a Genesis if you want, but honor the man's legacy, it's a Mega Drive.
The thing is, and I think one thing that's kind of, you know, that's kind of, people don't think really, really give them that much credit for is creating hardware for the arcade and the home is very different, because the arcade, obviously, you've got a, you want to make it cost effective. You want it to be, you've got a price ceiling, but it's a lot higher than a console. You know, arcades could cost thousands, because ultimately you're only going to create a few of them, a few thousand of them, give them out to people. At the time, you during the arcade's heyday, they'll rake money in hand over fist to a degree. You know, even like the Model 1, Model 2, Model 3, they were a lot like $20,000, those boards. Buying them from Lockheed Martin. You know, it's always makes me, when Jensen Huang talks about it, he's going, they bought it from defense. It was like
That
defense, yeah, it's like simulation technology. But he had the unenviable task of creating hardware for the home, which had to be amongst everything else. It had to be competitive, it had to be powerful, had to deliver certain aspects, whether it was kind of sprite scaling, whether it was multiple colors, whether it was screen scrolling, whether it was, you know, just a higher processor speed, but it all had to be done within a price bracket. And
yes.
you know, and he succeeded pretty much every time. I think the Saturn with its second SH2 does suffer a little, because even when that launched at the price it did, they were still losing money on it despite the price. But you look at something like the Dreamcast and how that launched for, you know, for that price, it was the lowest price of any console post the Saturn and PlayStation. And I don't think anything really launched that low again, which is
No, I think the
crazy.
closest to it was probably Xbox 360, and that was 279. You know,
Yeah.
I mean, I know Sega of Japan wanted it to be 250, but they stole their push for 199 and one. So that's that. Just take away those profit margins. That's that.
Yeah.
But I say, I mean, even if it was 250, man, Sega must have been losing money big time. Whenever we spoke to Peter Moore, he said that. He said that, you know, that they were relying on the attach rate, and it launched, like, Dreamcast had a really high attach rate for games. No wonder with that launch lineup, you know what I mean? People probably spoiled for choice the launch lineup, but
Yeah.
you know.
I always say that one of my most frustrating times to be a gamer was the year 2000, because there was so much on that Dreamcast that year, and I couldn't afford it all. You know, if I could, I would have bought everything. I don't know, maybe if they spaced it out a bit more, I could have kept it going. But time wasn't on their side. But you know, he did stuff that really was unheard of, was borderline impossible. You know, and you put the Famicom aside, everything else that he did was, you know, industry defining, had extremely long legs, especially like the Master System, as we said. The Mega Drive launched in 1988. The Super Nintendo wouldn't come until 2 years later, and the Mega Drive would still kind of compete with it all the way up until 96, effectively, and especially in the West. And then, as you say, the Saturn and PlayStation are still beloved by their communities to this day. So it's, obviously he's in recent years, he's not done anything any remotely as seismic as he did back in the 80s and 90s when he was creating this hardware. But, what's kept him engaged and what is his various interviews that he's done since. And he still talks about it with such a passion and such a fondness that, and you hear this a lot from people, don't you, mate? But that their best times were working for Sega, even kind of, the Virtua Cop team, the Sega Rally team, when they're doing any kind of interviews for Pandas videos, and they talk about that they'd go in, they'd sleep under the desk, they'd work like 80-hour weeks, and it's like, oh yeah, but they loved it, and you get the feeling from him, from all the interviews and stuff, everything that you hear from him, is that he loved it as well. It was his favorite time to be in work.
Aye, it's a different time, man. So again, we don't mean to kind of hate on modern gaming, but it has just become so generic. You know what I mean? And I think you touched it there, like the Virtua Cop team, the Sega Rally team, the long hours. I mean, I know people rightly we work in environments and things to talk about like crunch being bad, but while there was undoubtedly periods where people were probably doing crunch hours and maybe didn't enjoy it, but in that particular culture, I think it's Sega at that time, they were doing it because they loved to do it. It wasn't like there was like deadlines that were pushing them that they need to get it out. Like, there is interviews out there with the team saying that they were sleeping under a desk, but they love working on these games. It's they don't look back at these games and go, oh, fucking remember I worked on that. It's a horrible time, you know. But it's
I think it's
just
different, isn't it? I think back then games were so much smaller that you would see the outcome of what you were doing at that time. It's a bit like, and I know you've put out videos recently, and I'm like, how'd you do that? And you're like, I was up till 2:30 in the morning do editing this video, because you could just
parenting crunch, mate.
you can see you can but you can see the you can see every increase, every improvement when you get to the finish line. Whereas if you're on a movie, or if you're on, imagine working on a movie in the modern day is like working on a video game in the modern day. No, if you're in the effects studio, you're probably doing one CGI thing on like a, I don't know, if you're working on Jurassic World 7 or whatever it is, you're texturing one dinosaur's kneecap or something, and it's taking hours and hours, and you don't really see the fruits of what you've done. And imagine it's the same with people working on stuff like, I don't know, Grand Theft Auto. The teams are so vast for them. That when you kind of break it down, it's like, what have I really achieved by doing this? It's not like something like a game back then, or even Falco and with his Gains and J.M. Martin's, the work that he does. You see the stuff that he does, as that grows, and the rate that he's been able to do that, you imagine that he's getting a lot of satisfaction and is spurred on by the fact that he's all suddenly finds something, and all of a sudden, he gets an extra finds an extra few frames per second. The graphics are look better, etc., etc. So you can imagine that's the kind of the impetus of what the teams had then. And again, it all comes back to the hardware. That's Sato laid those foundations. He built the tools. Built the launch pad for them. He said, "There you go. Do with it what you need to."
That's it. I mean, look at what Frog Bull did with Minecraft as well, like implementing a three-level LOD system, you know, and he's got LOD Zero, you're up close, it's 16 by 16 textures, full effect, full detail textures like normal Minecraft. LOD One, if you go back, smaller, less detailed, 8 by 8, move out again to LOD Two, and you've got effectively its mesh transparencies that are, you know, essentially faking fade in. You know, it's like, and like you say, mate, that kind of stuff, and like even the teams that worked, the smaller teams on back in the day, games were smaller, obviously. You're right, seeing that kind of finish line, like if you know you've got three stages, you maybe get like even thinking about whenever Sega Rally was getting made, like they didn't make the stages in order. You know, they had, was it Forest Stage was worked on first, if I remember. you know, they got that in, and then they went back and built around it. But they had a timeline that was there that they could work to, much like whenever you stick your audio your script into Resolve, yeah, and you go and you drop your intro in, and you know you've got all that space to fill with video, but that's your finish line. You know, whenever you get there, it's, I'm not saying like making virtual cops that edit a video in Resolve, but it's that kind of, and what I'm saying is, like, you can see the end there, and you know what you've got to work on, and you're finding that time to make it. And you know, like you're saying, maybe up to like 2:30 AM, you know,
yep.
you find the time. I don't look at a video that I've sacrificed making sleep or getting sleep to make, sorry, and go fucking hate that video. It's like you're proud of your work, you know, however it came about. So the same for these guys, and obviously Sato's hardware is what gave them the platform to do that.
It is, mate. It is. And yeah, I was just taking a look at the some of the tributes that are on here, and I'll probably read a few out, but the Beep 21 one really kind of hit home, because it said, known as the father of Sega hardware, Mr. Hideki Sato passed away. He was a truly great figure who shaped the Japanese gaming history and captivated Sega fans all around the world. The excitement and pioneering spirit of that era will remain forever in the hearts and memories of countless fans for all eternity. Rest in peace. Our deepest condolences. I think that's from the Japanese perspective. I think that's an absolutely wonderful tribute to Mr. Sato there.
Yep. Absolutely, mate.
Yeah, lots of very similar tributes. The father of Sega hardware, rest in peace, legend. Yuzo Koshiro with Ancient Corp, obviously Yu Suzuki's studio that recently created Earthian. But, you know, Ancient Corp began development with Sonic the Hedgehog for the Master System. Mm-hmm. After that, from the iconic Mega Drive era all the way to the Dreamcast, I was fortunate to remain involved with Sega hardware development. And none of this would have been possible without the consoles designed by Mr. Hideki Sato. I am deeply grateful for everything that he created. Sending my thoughts to his family and loved ones. Thank you for everything. And, yeah. Beep 21 again, I was saying. Mr. Hideki Sato, known as the father of Sega hardware, passed away. His passion and bold spirit defined an era. Rest in peace. And it goes on, mate. And it's great to see. It's always kind of tragic that it takes this sort of thing to kind of bring it into focus.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, in instances such as this, when you have this sadness. And that's why when you see these people come together and you see people celebrating the life of Hideki Sato, someone that was so important to obviously his own family, but was also so important to Sega and was so important to us as Sega fans. And there may be Sega fans out there that didn't even know it, that this was the architect behind what it was that they were enjoying. But he was there, often kind of behind the scenes, not as celebrated as Yuji Naka, Yu Suzuki, or anyone else that you care to name. But he was always there, all the way through.
So, mate, I'm just very thankful that the stars aligned and things worked out the way they are. That I ended up playing on Sega systems and been able to experience games thanks to his systems. You know, it's, I couldn't imagine my gaming, you know, the formative years of my kind of gaming life being any other way. You know, it's, and well, we've all dabbled in other systems. We've all had plenty of PlayStations, numerous Xboxes, Nintendo consoles. There's just something different. You know, it's like, that's the thing as well, that we all kind of grow up and, you know, like tastes and kind of preferences all kind of change over time, you know. But then if you look at it, you always kind of come back. I think when it comes, especially with the Saturn, you always come back to the Saturn. And you think about the time that I kind of spent away. I sold everything in 2007 and had my Xbox 360, and I went away off down the modern gaming route, and I had, you know, PS3 and a Wii, and then, you know, Xbox One, PS4, you know. But whenever I got that message off my uncle, you know, in 2020, that he'd found the Saturn in the loft, and it kind of reignited it. You know, I was away from Saturn for 13 years. You know what I mean? But coming back to it, there was a a warmth, a familiarity, and just, as I said before, a soul to these games, to this system. There's something so different about you. You hold it in your hand, you look at it, the covers on the design, the wee window on the CD tray lid, positioning of the logos, the grills on the side, just the shape of it, the lines, everything about it. Just, as I said, just it's part of the experience. And as I say, things will come and go in your life. Some things go and never come back. Well, Saturn for me has always been there. It's my favourite. This for me, I know Dreamcast has got its massive fans, but this system for me is and always forever will be what means Sega to me. So thank you, Mr. Sato, for bringing this system into my life, and I'm thankful that I came back to it, and it's never going anywhere again. So
wonderfully said, mate. I mean, just on the back of that, I think the fact that he touched so many people's lives but also had that imprint, and someone put on something recently on social media saying, if you were a gamer in 1997, you played these games, and there was a bunch of Nintendo and PlayStation games on there. And there's a few people that replied saying, yeah, well, I was actually on Planet Saturn at that time. I enjoyed Sega Saturn games. And I thought, I stepped back and I was thinking, well, yeah, we actually did all play those games. We all played the big Nintendo 64 games. We played the big PlayStation games of the year. We played them all. But something about Sega meant that despite playing those, we kept coming back. And it's just exactly like you were saying just now, mate. It's that kind of that X factor, that something in Sega hardware stirred something inside us to make us the fans we are today. It built a connection. It created a platform for other artists to create their masterpieces, you know. And then they are masterpieces, whether it is from Yuji Naka, whether it's from Mizuguchi, whether it's from Yu Suzuki, and all the countless other kind of artists, composers. You know, the music chips are all part of it. We're talking about every facet of game development, you know. The Sega hardware gave these guys a platform to create their masterpieces, and that's what deeply connected us. And you know, at the root of it all, at the center of it all, is Hideki Sato, and I think that's what makes it so special, mate.
That's it, mate. It was essentially the glue that held it all together, wasn't it? You know, he was. Talk about VDP2 being the Sega Saturn's special sauce. Well, Hideki Sato was Sega's special sauce, mate.
He was perfect, mate. And I think, yeah, just a short one, this one, just to celebrate the life of the man that made such a difference, that created the hardware that we love so much, that allowed the games that we love so much to flourish. And we'd love to hear what you guys think. You know, we'd love to see your tribute. So please get involved, get in touch via the Discord or in the comments below, and share your appreciation and love for Hideki Sato, for everything that he did for Sega hardware, and for Sega fans. So really hope you've enjoyed this one. If you have, give us a like and subscribe, as that really helps the channel. And if you want to be extra mega, you can become a Sega Guys YouTube member. It costs as little as just 99p, with our Akira All Access members getting a bunch of perks, including getting their names read out as a special thank you, like James is about to right now.
Certainly, our Akira All Access members for today's show, we have G-Man, Steph Peak, I Am Mikowski, Craig Williamson, Resident SD, P-Wall, Peter 007, Nick Tullock, Greg Matthews, Tom Fum, Kaiju Leviathan, David Owens, Drickass Zero, Pablo Plays 98, Sancho 0813, Andy Mackey, Mr. Big Mac, Silver Spear 21, Schnapplur is our most recent Akira All Access member, and between recording podcasts, we have a new Panzer Dragoon Premium member who goes by the name of Gun Griffin. So thank you very much to all our members and subscribers for your continued support. As we say, just a short one today to honour Mr. Sato, a kind of off-the-cuff kind of recording to get this one out for you quickly. But as Dan said, just, you know, if you've got any kind of special things you want to say, about Sato-san, any kind of impact he's had on you guys, certainly leave them in the comments. It'd be nice to see some kind of community comments on there as well. I did put a post up on the community channel, and there's been a variety of posts kind of on there, not names I kind of recognize because it was a public post, so it'd be nice to see some of our kind of community as well getting involved in those comments and sharing those kind of their kind of tributes as well. So yeah, thank you guys.
Yes, thank you very much for staying with us until the end. So yes, love to hear your tributes to Mr. Sato. And if you don't feel like, you know, you might not want to leave a comment, but I'll tell you what you can do. You can go out there and you can go and play some classic Sega games on Sega hardware and celebrate the man in that way. And if you do, we'll see you on the Sega side.
Sega.